Listeners, and welcome to another hour of Advanced Living Radio. This is Kenneth Lesser, and thrilled and delighted to be your host again today. Oh, yes, every week we have a commitment. We're here with this program to, just with our deliberate and intense intention, to make things available that are going to support you on your path to having a fabulous life. And sometimes that's relieving stress, sometimes it's, who knows, just so many things. But it's an answer to a prayer, my daily prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, show me the best ways to have the most fun inspiring the largest number of people to easily, naturally, joyously experience vibrantly, exquisitely healthy, wealthy, passionate living in the shortest amount of time with the least intrusion into their lives so we can all get our needs met and celebrate a global loving community that works for everyone. Yes, so that's our target, and we are just so excited to bring you wonderful guests each week. And as we get into that, I want to take a moment to invite you, please, to check out our sponsor, and it's advancedlivingcomfort.com, and there you're going to find what people are referring to as a Clark Kent clock with superpowers. And right, you're wondering, well, look, it looks like a digital clock I'd have on my desk or by my nightstand or travel bag. What is this superpowers thing? Well, it's been specially modified so that when you plug it in, it creates an energetic harmonization that brings a level of coherence and energetic stability that helps you to overcome the stress of our high-tech electric world and just bring this pure, stable energy that is so good for you in so many ways. So check out advancedlivingcomfort.com and find out why people like Harvard MD Eva Selhub or Jack Canfield, author of Chicken Soup for the Soul books, so many others are just raving about how good this is. And now, talking about good things, oh, how many times have you thought, okay, what if I could just have a tune-up for my brain? And you may have seen scary movies where in the past they would do things with like shock treatment, and you're going, no, I don't think that's worth it. And so how about if we've evolved to the point where our guest today can talk about how extremely low voltage, stuff you could barely feel, can actually help us to solve so many of our serious problems. Yes, we have an expert today, Dr. Stephen Larson, an author and just an amazing practitioner. He's a PhD, LMHC, BCIA, EEG, which is about the EEG equipment, and he's Professor Emeritus of Psychology at SUNY University, New York University in Ulster, and he's board certified in EEG biofeedback and the author of several books, including the award-winning The Fundamentalist Mind and the Healing Power of Neurofeedback. And he's the founder and director of the Stone Mountain Center, offering biofeedback, neurofeedback, and psychotherapy treatments. He and his wife, Robin, live in New Paltz, New York, and he's going to share some amazing things with us today. Welcome aboard, Stephen.
Thank you, Kenneth. It's wonderful to be with you again.
Ah, a mutual pleasure. As we were saying before the show, I'd leave you alone for a while, and you just come up with more beautiful things like this amazing book. And now, for people that might not have heard that show that we've had in the past with you, would you talk briefly about your background, how you became interested in neurofeedback, and what neurofeedback is as it relates to your current wellness activities?
Well, I'm one of these people who has managed, Ken, to successfully channel his ADD into a variety of different kind of areas of interest. So one of my areas of interest as a psychologist is the brain and how the darn thing functions. And as someone once said, I'm trying to remember who, if the brain were simple enough for us to understand it, we'd be too stupid to understand it. So the brain is our constant challenge, riddle, anagram. The other area that I'm interested in, of course, is mythology, dreams, the imagination, creativity, and what the brain can actually do. So you could say one part is the hardware and the other part is the software.
Okay. Wow. Well, that sounds pretty exciting. And so these things all tie into your wellness program. Now, on the books that you've written, for instance, back in 06, you wrote a book about neurofeedback, and here you are writing another book about the subject. Maybe you can give a little bit about the previous one and then kind of help us bridge the gap onto this new book.
Well, in 2006, I had been studying the lens type of biofeedback or neurofeedback for about 10 years. That stands for low energy neurofeedback system. At that time, I believed that was really the kind of the acme of all neurofeedback systems, and in many ways, I still think that's the case because it does two things. It doesn't micromanage the brain. It doesn't tell the brain what to do. It allows it to regulate itself, and that's in that way, it was superior to any of the neurofeedback methods that had come along up to 2006. Because some of them, usually the brain is running too fast or too slow, one thing or the other, or it's running both too fast and too slow at the same time. Mm. Like, you're spinning your wheels, you're stuck in the mud, and you're not going anywhere. So you can have that kind of phenomenon. It sounds, but you're not doing anything, and so you get exhausted, and you say, well, I'm depressed, but your brain is actually running fast, and when you try to go to sleep at night, you can't stop the darn thing. So what Len Oakes had figured out is that if you give the brain a series of tiny, tiny stimulations, and it turns out we found out just before 2006 that it was in the radio frequency area, and we suspect that that's because the brain has a substance called magnetite in it. It's a ferromagnetic material, and just like migrating birds or fish, the brain responds to, you know, electromagnetic pulses and signals. If you feed the brain back its own energy, you could say its own face in a dewdrop. It's a piece of biofeedback. It just gives it back what it's doing. It immediately makes corrections. So it's a self-regulating organ. We don't know that about the brain, but it's doing it all the time, sometimes, you know, hundreds of times a second. It's kind of readjusting itself. And we take advantage of that. This also ties into a concept called neural plasticity that wasn't so well accepted when I wrote that book in the early new millennium. But now there is really substantial evidence about neural plasticity by major people, Elizabeth Gould, Alvaro Pasquale Leone at Harvard. It's now, neural plasticity is pretty much accepted all over the world. The brain regenerates itself. It builds new neurons. It regulates itself. And if we can take advantage of that, it's a pretty darn smart ally. So that's what the new book is about. The new book is about what has happened since 2006. We have a whole raft of new brain technologies that we use along with the lens, intra-low frequency training and hemoencephalography and something magical called Z-score training, trying to let the brain kind of figure out whether it's in a kind of a normal operating mode or not. And almost all of these, it's sort of like having a Nautilus for your brain. Having a Nautilus for your body, you get stronger, more flexible every time you use the darn thing. Well, why don't we have one of those for the brain? And now we do. So that's what we're excited about. And it's not just simply training for optimal performance, although that's one of the more exciting parts of it, but it's also helping people with a variety of problems where they've gotten kind of into a rut or a ditch or something like that, if you will. That is to say, depression, anxiety, the sequelae or the after effects of head injury, a whole bunch of things that I take up. I take chapters with each one of these topic areas and then give case studies about the people who have been helped.
Wow. This is fabulous. And now, when you were talking about kind of educating the brain, is that the Z-score training thing?
Yes. The Z-score training is a part of it. Not until computer technology and solid-state circuitry had developed to the point where it is now, could we even think about processing, you know, millions of bits of information per minute and giving the brain back the kind of information that it can really, really make use of. And we are doing that now. And Z-score training, live Z-score training, if you're training 21 sites of the brain at the same time as you can do with a full cap apparatus, you can see what's going on in the brain. And there's a new development of that called Loretta Z-score training, where you can train the deeper areas of the brain. And we've entered the 21st century now in terms of brain science. There's a huge amount we don't know, but there's just enough that we know to really be able to help people. And this is the exciting thing, Kenneth, to be able to help people without just over-reliance on drugs.
Yeah. Geez. Well, that's, to me, fabulous. I don't know how many folks have not seen a commercial on TV for some sort of pharmaceutical, and my gosh, they're telling people, well, here, if you have this or if you have that symptom, then you need this, and go tell your doctor. And, oh, by the way, there could be some terrible side effects of this. And so you're saying, wow, we can step out from that kind of scenario and do some work with what you're talking about, and there's not these drugs involved, and yet you're seeing it's incredibly effective. Is that right?
That's right. Instead of a huge chemical inundation, I mean, it's not that modern-day drugs don't have their theater of efficacy. Many of them do, and there are anti-psychotic agents and antibiotics and all those kinds of things. But when you're talking chemistry, you've got a massive inundation of some kind of bioactive chemical. It may not even be from an organic source, and you're pumping that into the brain, and of course there are going to, or into the body, of course there are going to be side effects. We didn't realize it, but the drug that is now called Rogaine, for example, was used for a totally different purpose. I can't remember what it was, but then they discovered that it was growing hair all over people. They said, "Oh, we'll market this thing as a drug for growing hair." When a drug does have side effects, then the pharmaceutical companies are very savvy. They will sell you another drug to cope with the side effects of that. Now, that one could also have side effects, and then we'll sell you another drug to cope with the side effects of that, so that people sometimes have, you know, half a dozen or a dozen pharmaceuticals in their system at one time, and that could be toxic.
Wow. So to me, this is so exciting, and I guess maybe this ties in a little bit with giving us some more about why these neurofeedback treatments would be considered revolutionary.
Well, yeah, because energy medicine was kind of banned at the beginning of the 20th century. They said it was all kind of quackery. Back in the 1900s, I can remember my grandpa had a little device for his arthritis. He would turn a crank and hold one hand on one handle and another hand on another handle, and he said it helped. They kind of, the American Medical Association kind of said, that's really quackery. We're going to tell you what is an efficacious medicine through our placebo-controlled, peer-reviewed, gold standard process. And that is fine. I have a lot of good friends who are physicians and psychiatrists, and some of them are very, very skillful prescribers. But there are many parents, for example, who don't want to give their kids drugs. I'll give you one simple example. I'm treating a kid who was just arrested on felony charges for dealing an ADD drug, which the doctor prescribed to another kid. And the kid had a lunchbox full of Adderall. And Adderall is basically speed or dexedrine. And that kid sold the first kid some drugs, and the kid made a 50% markup and started selling it to some other kids. And the school systems are full of this kind of thing. And the kids aren't just taking it for enhanced learning ability. They are breaking open those capsules and shoving it up their nose and getting high off it. And so we live in a drug culture. And it's just, you're saying if you turn on television, you do see these ads. And they're everywhere, and they're paid for by big, big financial backing.
Yeah. Okay. And so here, with the neurofeedback, is he starting to make some headway of getting some of the AMA behind it, or where's the status of that?
Well, we're making infinitesimal progress because compared to the pervasiveness of the standard pharmaceutical approach, biofeedback, neurofeedback is very, very tiny. I think the attitude has shifted a little bit, and I just recently saw an ad for, I think, an ADD drug or an ADHD drug, and said, this is almost as effective as neurofeedback, and I almost dropped in my tracks because
wow.
I had never seen that before. But people ask me about neurofeedback, and of course the disinformation campaign says it's lengthy, it's technical, it's expensive, takes a long time, and some of those things are true. You have to work at it. And yet, people say, well, are there side effects? Yes, and they're all good. In other words, the side effects are not the consequences of putting an alien substance into your body. The side effects are what happens when you bring the central nervous system and the brain into finer tune than it was before. So I take down about 5 symptom areas with each patient when we start. And before we're done, we want to know that they've got substantial improvements in all of them. For example, if they come for anxiety, I want to know if they have insomnia. If they have anxiety and insomnia, I want to know how their digestion and gastrointestinal stuff goes. And I want to find out how their mood is in terms of stability. I want to find out if they suffer from pain symptoms. And we track all of these things. I have an excellent medical doctor on my staff, and I have other physicians we refer to, and the doctors can check on it and see how we're doing. People will learn to relax and lower their blood pressure. They will learn to enter sleep more easily and sleep more restfully. They will learn to solve problems. That's a big one that people come for, is the cognitive enhancement. That's kind of like a fine tune, again, like you were saying before, like tune with the brain. I say to people sometimes, gee, you've got a really nice Jaguar or Lamborghini or something like that of a brain. This thing is unbelievable. Only thing is your timing is off, or your fuel injectors are clogged. Let's get that fixed.
Wow.
And when they do, it purrs along and they're doing just fine. Then our biggest goal is to make ourselves obsolete. We don't need people to go through treatment the rest of their lives. I and most of my staff take treatments every week or every other week if we can. And just like a little tune-up. And then you go back to work and see how you're doing. And, of course, it's available to us.
Mm-hmm. Ah, so you
know
keep
how it...
track of for you and your staff. In other words, I'm from what I see in your book, I mean, there's, like, detailed drawings of different things in the brain and areas that are stimulated. So you keep track of that for you and the staff as well as your patients?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And most of my staff are people that have at one time or another had a head injury or Lyme disease or some kind of major problem, and they know how they were before they started treatment, and they know how they feel afterwards. Again, that's one reason why I was so excited by your comfort clock idea, because I think it runs on basically the same principle. It's harmonizing the energy field that we live in. Now, I have a comfort clock on the wall behind me right now, and I think we sleep better because of it.
Mm. Oh, that's great. Well, I certainly want to figure out the ways that we can support people, and with what you're talking about, to me, this is, I'm just wondering, there's a principle where, you know, let's say someone is tying shoes or driving a car, doing a particular task, and it's difficult at first, but then with some practice, it gets to the point where they're good at it. And the metaphor people have said, well, once you learn how to ride a bicycle, you can always get back on and be able to do that again. And I'm wondering, are you finding that once you get the brain kind of more stable and heading in the right direction, does it begin to increase its self-correcting abilities? Or
I think it does. That's a really, really good question, Ken. I think there is a kind of a, what should we call it, like a metacognition, an ability of the brain to ask itself, how am I doing, boss? How are things going? Am I solving problems easily? Am I, you know, kind of emotionally in balance? Am I having negative self-talk a lot of the time? And psychotherapies, of course, approach this from a different angle. Rationally motive therapy says, well, stop the negative self-talk and you'll be okay. But that's very hard for some people.
Mm-hmm.
They came from a family where criticism and invasive, negativistic kind of atmosphere was pervasive, and it really is kind of hard to overcome that. What we love about the neurofeedback, and I think the lens started us realizing this, is you don't have to... A biofeedback is a learning experience, but the effects of it are at a subliminal, automatic, almost classical conditioning level. That is to say, it's a little bit like Pavlov's salivating dog. You don't have to think, there is a nice piece of food. I think I'll salivate right now and so I can eat it.
Yeah.
You don't have to think a lot of things out. They just happen by themselves. Here comes the food. You salivate. And what is when you hear about Zen Buddhists? What is Zen? Chopping wood and carrying water. After enlightenment, what is Zen? Chopping wood and carrying water, only doing it very well, and in harmony with yourself as you do it.
Wow! So that's pretty exciting. Now, as I'm understanding more, there's some people that, for instance, PTSD, so many folks, even if they haven't been in the military, they've been through some form of a traumatic event. It could be an injury, it could have been, you know, something, some brutality. And then on the other end, we're also talking about with heart problems being such a pervasive thing in our culture, stroke. And I'm understanding that you can do some wonderful things with your techniques on those conditions.
That's one of the most exciting chapters in the new book, Ken, is the chapter on a friend of ours, Michael Schacher, who had a massive stroke that took out almost his entire left hemisphere. It was said he would never walk or talk again. And just a couple of weeks ago, he walked into our therapy center unassisted, and he's talking pretty good. His vocabulary is up to a couple of thousand words now. After neurofeedback and a technique his wife developed called the sensory trigger, and you can find out about Barbara Schacher's work at a place called strokefamily.org. She gives people actual training techniques to overcome stroke. Amazingly enough, her own father got a stroke. I think she was 13 years old. She became a research librarian, and as part of her training, she developed a method called sensory trigger stroke family method, and she basically cured her father. He was speaking, I think he had a 500-word vocabulary, and he was able to walk around by himself when she was done. Now, combining our method of neurofeedback with Barbara's method of sensory trigger, her husband, Michael, had a stroke maybe 5 years ago, and he is like a Renaissance man, a real cultural genius, and writer, songwriter, composer, performing musician, and he was working on his book Spring Without Bees when he overworked, and all of a sudden, right in the middle of this thing, got this terrible stroke. His wife, Barbara, had had some kind of premonitory dreams, and she jumped right on it, Googled his symptoms, drove him at 70 miles an hour to the local hospital, got him medevaced to Albany, got the aortic dissection, that's what it was, repaired, and it was said he'd have a 50% chance of having a stroke, and he did. But now he is walking, talking. His first two words were not dog or cat, but metaphysics and sentient beings.
Wow.
The first two words he said.
So he's
and,
definitely
that story is told,
things.
That story is told in there along with pictures of him. And here's the other exciting thing I did, Ken, and I'm trying to decide how to do this. At the open house that we had at our center, Stone Mountain Center, last month, I had some of the major cases, or if they were children, their families, come into our center, and I had them professionally videotaped and audiotaped. And telling their story, and it is just inspiring. You see Michael talking, and he can sing beautifully on stage and perform. Now, you see the case of a young woman who was adopted from the former Soviet Union with a attachment disorder, and she used to be a holy terror. She used to lie, steal, cheat, was doing horribly in school, couldn't sleep at night, just. You know, adopted children have the adopted family has a really tough time sometimes because the children have missed developmental milestones that in a normal setting would, you know, be in place, but they don't have that kind of nurturance early in life. And so with neurofeedback, biofeedback, you can do a lot of repair work, a lot of help. And I won't say it's a miracle, and people say, well, look, how can one size fit all? And it's not one-size-fitting-all. It's that the equipment is flexible enough to adapt to the signals that come in and start from right where the person is at. And this poor kid, when we did a brain map on her, it's called a quantitative EEG, her brain looked like a plate of spaghetti. Mm-hmm. And when I talked to the school system, there was somebody at the school system who had adopted a kid. I think he was a counselor. Very nice guy. And we had a briefing session where I talked to the entire school board, and I said, this kid is not lazy, willful, criminal, mischievous. She was adopted from Siberia when she was 2 years old, and she's got neurological problems. And here's what the brain map says. Mm-hmm. I got the school board to pay for the brain mapping. And
wow.
Doing way, way better now. I have the case of a feral child. You know what that is? F-E-R-A-L. This is a child who was in the Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts and who had a crack-addicted mother.
Oh.
I think she was addicted while she was carrying the child. And the child, when it came to the attention of the biofeedback community, had no language, not toilet trained, lived on the floor, ate out of a bowl like an animal, sometimes didn't have food, would howl at night. I mean, it was really a mess.
Mm.
And one of my colleagues, a wonderful teacher named Seaburn Fisher, was able to, with a couple of her colleagues, get this kid very far along, and then we started treating him. And now, when you meet him, you meet a handsome 16, 17-year-old, comes walking into the room, shakes your hand, looks you in the eye, says, "How are you doing? I like these treatments." And he was like an animal. That story is told in there.
Mm, wow. Wow, now that's huge.
Yeah, that's fun. Oh, and Ken, I didn't want to ignore your raising the issue of post-traumatic stress disorder. This is a big thing in our world. We live right next to New York City. We have 9/11 survivors. We have people that have come back from the war. We have lots of trauma in today's world, and trauma leaves an indelible stamp on the nervous system. It's ready for the other shoe to drop. It's ready to jump out the window. It's ready for something truly horrible to happen. And we can kind of short-circuit that existing ingrained trauma in the nervous system. It's kind of amazing. We use a couple of methods, one called the havening by a couple of colleagues of mine, Ron and Steve Rudin, and that is dramatically effective. And we use that with neurofeedback. And we've been able to, I've worked with dying people, with people from the Haitian earthquakes who lost their entire family. And boy, talk about trauma. I said, "You look traumatized. Tell me what has happened to you." "Well, my mother is dead, my father is dead, 4 brothers and sisters, and I lost my house and the entire neighborhood." Mm-hmm. I said, "Oh, I think that qualifies you to be traumatized."
Yeah, there's a hint of trauma there, I believe.
Just a little hint of trauma, yeah.
Yes.
And this is, I mean, this is not the best of all possible worlds, I suppose, but these things do happen, and it is so heartwarming to realize that you can actually help people who have had terrible, invasive things happen in their lives like that.
Mm. Wow. I mean, to me, when I think of, there's a TV series with Kevin Costner, The Hatfields and the McCoys, which is just one example of people carrying on to mutual detriment generation
yes.
to generation, terrible things. And we see different parts of the world where that has been played out for many centuries. And to me, I'm just beginning to think, well, what if we could relieve some of those traumas so that those same things weren't being triggered for people from generation to generation, and they could actually be able, it sounds like this could be a peacemaker of a technique.
That's it. You're exactly right, Ken. It could be a peacemaker of a technique. I was recently lecturing with my wife, Robin, at a conference, Robert Bly's great conference, and we were talking about the story of Parsifal in the Middle Ages, and I just in the middle of the lecture, I said, "You know, it's entirely possible that the entire Middle Ages, including the Crusades, were enacted by people with head injuries."
Mm-hmm.
And the entire audience starts laughing because there in the pictures that we have it, there are people with broadswords and maces and spears and throwing rocks off the parapets of castles. I mean, the entire thing was enacted by people with head injuries. They're all crazy.
Yeah.
And thus it goes on. And then, you know, they didn't even have the concept PTSD. They called it, I believe, shell shock in World War I. General Patton is famous for, or battle fatigue, shell shock.
Mm-hmm.
General Patton was famous for, a soldier came apart in his presence, and he publicly pistol-whipped the guy for being, and called him a coward, for having a neurological response to unimaginable horror of war. And that was the old method. You know, the old method was, you know, get a stiff upper lip, soldier, get back in there and fight.
Yeah.
Well, you're asking me to do something unbelievably cruel and crazy. And many soldiers fire above the heads of the enemy because they can't stand the thought of killing somebody.
Yes.
Wisely. Yeah.
Yeah. There is a growing amount of compassion of people just saying they don't want to participate. Amy Goodman on Democracy Now for the Veterans Day, there were actually a group of veterans that were there at a major gathering, and they were getting rid of the medals they'd received in war, saying that, you know, this was wrong, we don't want to participate, we're not going to receive a decoration for something like that. So people are waking up, and now, well, you're not just saying, well, here, let's, you know, put this concept out here, but we now have a method to help you overcome traumas that you've had, and you didn't have to go to war to be in them. There's a whole lot of trauma that we have in our society. So,
yeah, I agree. And we don't have to go to war to have trauma. There are accidents enough, and plagues, and natural disasters, and earthquakes, and tsunamis. We'd have no trouble making a living treating trauma regardless. But then you add a war on top of that, and the kinds of accidents and untoward events that happen in war, these improvised explosive devices go off underneath your Humvee, and then you have PTSD and TBI because you were not only blown across the road, your buddies all died, and you come back, and they don't have much to offer you except tranquilizers.
Mm. Now, how are you doing? Is there progress being made for the military to look at this? I mean, I don't know that they would look at it.
I hear every so often really positive signs that the forward-thinking people in the military who listen to new trends and new directions are starting to take biofeedback quite seriously. And I've met some of them at these national conferences that we go to a couple of times, and it's been really, really a positive experience to see these guys. And they even have biofeedback equipment that they can do QEEGs in the field now, quantitative EEGs and other kinds of biofeedback procedures. And you can even train soldiers to be kind of like Jedi warriors. They have learned techniques already built into their system so that when they see trauma right on the hoof, they can calm themselves down and deal with it and, you know, apply those techniques that they've learned right to the situation.
Mm. Wow. Well, so that, and some of that relates to the neurofeedback stuff you're doing.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Wow.
I think the neurofeedback, you'll like the new book, Ken. There are so many things that were not available when I wrote the first one. I know we had a detailed discussion of that. There were some astonishing head injury cases in there, and your old standard, depression, anxiety, and so on. But we now have these attachment disorder cases. I had to do a lot of learning about this. I'm on a continual self-education process, learning new things all the time. There's no other choice.
Yeah.
with the population of people that I treat. And as I say, I work interactively with many physicians, psychiatrists, holistic practitioners, and they will manage the meds or make dietary or nutritional recommendations. They'll check the physiology, the vital signs, and there's one study that's quite exciting that I saw recently. It's just in my mind, so I can't give you all the references on it, but this was using biofeedback, particularly HRV training. That's one of the things we use, heart rate variability, a little bit like heart math.
Mm-hmm.
They had people that were going to receive open heart surgery or coronary bypass or that kind of thing. They wanted them to learn the heart math so their heart systems would be more resilient so they could sustain the surgery. Well, after 2 months of the training, they checked a large population, a large portion of the population, and they didn't need the surgery anymore.
Wow. Wow. So the heart repaired itself?
Well, this thing that we do called HRV, or heart rate variability, this is really not so much neurofeedback, but biofeedback. Basically, you train people to breathe in a disciplined way, in such a way that with each inhalation and exhalation, the heart speeds up about 10 beats per minute and then slows down about 10 beats per minute. That's a healthy heart. They used to say that a healthy heart was rock steady in the beat, and that's absolutely wrong. Your heart has to leap when you see an attractive person or a beautiful natural scene, a sunset or a waterfall or something like that. It's just fine for the heart to leap. That's the stuff that poetry is made from. Yeah, yeah. So that's one of the things that we do with every single patient that comes through our office. We not only train their brains, we teach them these breathing techniques so they have take-home learnings that they can do. You can read about this at the Heart Math Institute. Dr. Lou Childre was a visionary person, but many, many people, a colleague, Paul Lehrer, and there are many people who are doing the Steve Elliott teaching coherent breathing techniques. My friends Dr. Richard Brown and Patricia Gerbarg, a couple of MD psychiatrists, have been doing this in the wartime victims of the Sudan. They're helping people right on the spot in the battlefield or, you know, the killing fields after things have happened, teaching people to get control of their minds and bodies without drugs.
This is outstanding.
It really is. So back to the heart math stuff, what they found in that study that I was citing is that if people have a resilient cardiovascular system, think of the heart's little job. It's a fist-sized organ, and it's got this job of pumping these gallons of blood through miles and miles of arteries and capillaries and veins and back in again. If the whole thing is in sync with itself and pulsing like a huge elastic plastic organ, plastic not in the sense of the substance plastic, but it's adaptable to whatever is going on, then you have a healthy heart. If the heart is struggling against a buildup of plaque due to bad diet or other kinds of things, or cholesterol in the veins or that kind of thing, then the heart is overworking and people get early cardiovascular events of some kind. But if you train and work with your heart every day, that little organ gets stronger, and that's what happened to the people in that experiment. They didn't need the radical intervention of the surgery because already they had self-regulated. That's the whole idea of biofeedback, is the self-regulating power of the mind or the body. And why aren't we taught this in kindergarten? Why aren't we taught, okay, children, you're a little wild and unruly today. Let's do some breathing for about 5 minutes now. We want to teach each of you how to breathe so you can get nice and calm and do the next kind of thing. And by the way, here's how you approach your next learning task, whether it's math or history or whatever it is. We're not taught how to learn. We're not taught about ourselves. We're taught a series of seemingly disconnected things about the gross national product of Ecuador. And we go, well, that's useful.
I certainly am one of a growing number of people that is excited to see how there can be revisions in the curriculum that could be so huge for the quality of society. When there's debilitations or people upset, and then it turns into drug use or violence or crime, I mean, the cost is huge. And adding your stuff in in an educational matter, to me, well, we talk about huge savings and financially as
huge.
Well as quality of life.
Huge savings, Ken, and you're doing your part with Advanced Living by having on the kinds of teachers reaching a really pretty diffuse and large audience where you're letting people know, hey, you've got options. And there are people out there that care about how well you live your life and the quality of your life.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Now, I'm wondering, because I'm sitting here thinking, my gosh, people hearing this are going to be going, well, we don't live near New York City to go to the Stone Mountain Counseling Center. How many places are set up? And then another question is, I'm sitting here listening to you, and I don't even know if this is possible. I was imagining what I would call like data gathering centers, and I'm in a where a person may not have all your training, but they could perhaps get some of this neural feedback and then submit it to you or part of your team, and then you could make recommendations and have people out in the field. I don't know if you can, you know, direct and say, okay, tune the instrument this way, and I'm not even sure that's possible, but it was my mind saying, how could we get this to a lot more people more easily?
Yes, that's a great question. And to start with the first part of what you asked, there are two national organizations I talk about in my book. One of them is called the AAPB, the Association for Applied Psychophysiology and Biofeedback. I think it's aapb.org. And there will be lists of practitioners, either biofeedback or neurofeedback. Then there is the ISNR, the International Society for Neurofeedback and Research. And I think that's ISNR.org. And they will have lists of practitioners. The LENS approach, Low Energy Neurofeedback System, it's Oaks Labs, OCHSLABS.com. And they're the people who manufacture that LENS type of equipment. My fondest dream, Ken, would be to see, you know, my first book actually did have some effect on the world because there are twice as many LENS practitioners in the world. I think they're about 400 or 500 now than there were when I first started. There were about 200. We're gradually, because when people find out how this stuff works and they see the effects on people, all the way from kids with attention deficit disorder that you don't want to put on drugs, to athletes who want to learn optimal performance to perfect their, you know, competitive sports edge or whatever they do. There are people out there that want to learn about this stuff, and why not? We're at a stage in technology where electronic machines drive us crazy, right? The robots on the answering machine, the computers are at the point where the Frankenstein monster is out of the box, and, you know, another robocall when you're trying to enjoy your evening at home, and here they come. So we're all being driven crazy by electronic technology. Well, biofeedback and neurofeedback are pressing electronic gadgetry into the service of health and healing.
So this is huge, because the name you may have heard of, smart meters, where utility companies are putting on these radio transmitting things that they can send the signals back and monitor people's use of electricity and just really kind of snoop in their home, but they've now got this broadcast tower, and there's more people that were already overloaded with electro pollution, and now this is added
now
in.
Drones are going to be looking in our windows.
Yeah, so it's but just exciting that with these things that you're talking about, is we have a way of bringing ourselves back into a state of better balance.
I start my book, Ken, with a little. I'm a little funny when I let myself go, and I talk about the little robot that does not lie. A biofeedback machine is a little robot that does not lie, and you can always count on it to tell the truth. Well, what a great adjunct that is to a psychotherapeutic process. I tell a story of a woman who had learned how to do this emotional technique called primal scream, and she would persuade every therapist that they were the best therapist in the world because as soon as they'd ask her a question, she'd start to scream. If they thought that was what the goal of therapy was, well, they'd get what they asked for. And then I said, would you mind if I hooked you up to this little robot just for a minute? It's a GSR machine. And I hooked her up to it, and she was absolutely flatlined. And I said, okay, my dear, I don't in any way want to insult you, but this is a carefully rehearsed act that you have worked on with lots of therapists. Let's get down to business and talk about what's really wrong.
Mm.
And it was revolutionary for her.
Wow. That's huge.
And I had a robot in my office.
Yeah, and so you could help make a breakthrough where she could participate in the process, and it took out of this subjective part into something that was right there for her to participate with you.
She couldn't use a dramatic manifestation to blow me out of the water because I had a little pal there, my little electronic pal. Mm. And it measured her galvanic skin response and said, you aren't feeling what you're manifesting.
Uh-huh.
And likewise, I had somebody said, I can control my heart, I can control my blood pressure, and all this kind of stuff. He was kind of a boastful guy. And I said, oh, I just have a little device in my valise over here. Would you like to try it out? And he couldn't do anything that he talked about. And I said, you know, you've spent a lot of money on yoga and meditation, stuff like that. Let's see if you could actually do something here and learn something. And he was a reluctant learner, but then he had to face the music. He couldn't control his heart.
Wow. And that's where these things come in about different biofeedback techniques that we can learn.
Well, you go into some of that in the book? That's where the machines come in. The machines are just, many of them are fairly simple. Some of them are more sophisticated. The EEG, the brain stuff, is fascinating because, you know, the first title I came up with for this book was Peeking Under the Hood. Many of us don't have the vaguest idea what is actually going on in our brains because there are no sensory neurons in the brain. That's why people can have open brain surgery and they don't feel a thing. So we have a poor monitoring of what's going on. You can wake up in the morning and be, you know, and kick your cat and shout at your spouse and all this kind of stuff, and what's wrong? I'm grumpy today. Oh, I'm so glad you said it. It doesn't have to do with the cat. It doesn't have to do with the spouse. Let's get a grumpometer out, and let's see what's making you grumpy. we very often don't have a way of understanding the, what should we say, the background issues that make us behave as we do. I'm a little wired today. Have you ever noticed if you're coming down with an illness that you can be irritable for a day or two and you don't even know why, and then all of a sudden you're sick, and the cat's out of the bag?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And after a while, you get good at that, by the way. And Ken, going back to your earlier comment or question. I just love these interviews with you, by the way, because you really are such a great conversationalist, and you're just so right there listening to everything that's going on. Can people learn one skill and it transfers over to other skills? Can you learn to cope with trauma when a new one comes along that you didn't even plan on? And I think the answer is yes. I think we can learn to field the balls that come our way, and we can learn to be stronger, more resilient, more loving people.
Mm. Wow, this is just fabulous. We've probably got about 60 seconds. I don't know if there was some just overriding thought that you'd like to our listeners to carry with them about neurofeedback?
Well, my overriding thought is keep listening to Advanced Living. You have a really good guide here, a Virgil to the inferno sometimes that we all live in, who will take you along and expose you to new kinds of things. And listen to holistic practitioners. Work on yourself. Do yoga. Do physical exercise. Meditate as often as you can. You don't need technology to learn to self-regulate. You can learn how to do it, and you can learn how to teach others how to do it.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you, Stephen, for taking time. And folks, remember, StoneMountainCenter.com for the website and the book. And the title of your book, again, real quick, is?
The Neurofeedback Solution. We are going to be doing an open house, I think it's the second Saturday in July, for people that live on the East Coast. And I have patients, and I show videos and give demos of how you can do self-monitoring and self-healing techniques. And that's how we get a lot of people that come. They see what we're doing, and they become our patients. And we have a large and happy population of such people.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for taking time. And to you, Stephen, Dr. Larson, and to my beloved listeners, as we wrap up, to say to you, God bless, and goodbye for now.